Welcome to the 8th Annual Homelessness Marathon, a national dialogue on homelessness and poverty in America. The toll-free call-in number for this broadcast is 1-877-NOBODY-8. That's the word nobody, followed by the number 8. Or, if you're currently, recently, or about to be homeless, you may also call 1-866-LEFT-OUT. During the Great Depression, makeshift shanty towns sprang up across America, including perhaps some of America's first integrated neighborhoods. But America doesn't want homeless people living in shanty towns and campgrounds anymore. Is Canada any better? We'll take a look at green spaces as safe spaces in a simulcast with the Canadian Homelessness Marathon right after this.
Hard times are here again.
I'm speaking with Mike Rhodes, who's the editor of the Community Alliance newspaper in Fresno, California. Last year when I spoke to you, Mike, you were talking about how homeless people had been rounded up by the local authorities, their camps dispersed, put into prison-like communities where they were expected to check in and go past barbed wire just for a place to sleep. Has anything changed?
Yeah, it has, actually. There have been developments in Fresno over the last year. One of them was a proposal, at first a proposal for an outdoor drunk tank, which was to be established at the rescue mission in Fresno, which is the area where a lot of the homeless people live in the downtown area. The idea behind this was to put people behind this enclosed facility. It's under an underpass that would be monitored by guards from the rescue mission, and people who had been drinking in public would be held for an indefinite period of time. This was passed unanimously by the city council. I and several other people in Fresno objected to this development. We suggested that maybe they should put one of these up at the upscale shopping center in North Fresno called River Park, where they could put some of the upper class drinkers in for public gawking, and that was not met with approval by the city council. But the one in the rescue mission was, and so that is proceeding. You know, we expect them to get that going at any time now, if it's not already.
So this is really like a return to the stocks or something, where people have a public humiliation for these social crimes, in quotes?
It is, and, you know, they're very specifically locating it right in the epicenter of the homeless population in Fresno.
Mm-hmm.
To humiliate, create as terrible of conditions for Fresno's homeless as they can. I mean, they thought of everything else. They've passed ordinances to ban panhandling. They have an advertising campaign to urge people not to give money to the homeless because they'll only use it for drugs, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And now this.
Have they actually said this is for social uplift, we'll set an example and stuff? And have they actually used these words, or is it just that you assume that's what must be in their thinking?
Well, you know, I went down and talked to Larry Arce, who's the director at the Fresno Rescue Mission,
mm-hmm.
and interviewed him. He said he had met with the police chief, Dyer, in Fresno, and they were concerned about public drunkenness and that they wanted to come up with an alternative to sending people to jail over public drunkenness.
Mm-hmm.
And so they hit upon, well, how about an outdoor drunk tank at the Fresno Rescue Mission? That would solve a lot of our social problems. We wouldn't have to book people, and, you know, there's booking fees and all this. So, you know, when we went to the city council, we said, well, you know, look, there's nobody on staff here that is qualified to deal with alcoholism. It gets really hot in Fresno in the summer, like up to 110 degrees, and you're going to have these people outdoors. They could be inebriated, they could be drunk, they could be passed out. You know, somebody's going to die, and then what? And the other thing was that it's for men only. So there's a clear conflict here between how they treat women who have been picked up drinking and how they pick up men. They put men in an outdoor drunk tank, and they do whatever they do with women. It's something completely different, but it's, you can't have laws that are applied one way for one gender and one a different way for a different gender.
Why did the rescue mission go along with this? What was their thinking?
Oh, I think it's a great idea. Mm-hmm. Because, for one thing, it's a very religious organization. It's a very fundamentalist Christian organization that runs the rescue mission. They see this as a way of harvesting sheep. Larry Arce himself told me that they would encourage people to find a path with Jesus that will set them straight. And they have services in the rescue mission. They will hope to divert people into their faith and away from the streets. That's their stated goal.
Okay, Mike Rhodes, editor, Community Lines newspaper of Fresno, California. Thank you so much for your contribution to the Homeless Assist Marathon.
Our own edition of the Homeless Assist Marathon in the States, and we must say and acknowledge that the work of the Homeless Assist Marathon in the States created a path for this Homeless Assist Marathon here in Canada. I'd like to welcome Nobody to the Canadian Marathon here. Nobody, founder of the U.S. Marathon. Are you there?
Yes, I am, and thank you for
we
having me.
Nobody
simulcasting.
Just yet. We'll pull him through. As soon as you get through on the line, Nobody, go ahead and give us a shout. So that
well,
we know
I'm
that
here.
You're there.
Can anybody hear me?
The U.S. Marathon was founded some 8 years ago in the States by a community broadcaster as a way to reclaim the public media sphere that community radio has access to in the States, the same kind of access that community radio has here in Canada. Somewhat greater access here based on the campus and community radio stations that exist across this country, more and more of which are signing on to carry the annual Homelessness Marathon.
Gretchen, can you hear me?
Some 27 towns and cities across this country this year in our third annual edition. We also have on the line with us Russell Mace, Tent City, who's staying at Tent City 3 in Seattle. Russell, are you on the line with us?
Yes, I am. Good morning.
Russell, it's quite late here in Montreal, or quite early. We're 12 hours into our 14-hour homelessness marathon here, and I hear that Tent City 3 has been around for a while in Seattle. I wonder if you can introduce us to Tent City 3. Explain us a bit about this place that you live.
Well, Tent City 3 has been around for about 5 years. The inception of the 10 cities in the greater Seattle area has been since the early 1990s. The mayor back then gave us a plot of land. It's now a combination of our baseball field and our football field, Quest Stadium. In the past, we've had, we're Tent City 3. We have a sister, Tent City 4. In the 1990s, the city bulldozed one of our camps, Tent City 2. Our Tent City 3 has been, to quote it, hassled by the government since 2002 in legal action with the city of Seattle. They offered us private land for temporary, for a little bit. Our sister, Tent City 4, is the only one that exists in conjunction with us. The original Tent City, Tent City 1, did manage to get inside and is now located within the city limits in a building called the Aloha. It's an old hotel. And they've had a certain amount of success. Now us, we've been at 45 different sites throughout the city of Seattle. We've had the good fortune of being invited back to, 30 of those sites have repeats. So,
Gretchen, can you hear me?
A little bit of history about our 10 cities there.
Russell, can you describe what you're talking about when you say a tent city?
Well, we depending on the site and depending on our host, you walk up on 3 to 4 acres of tents of all size. Pup tents, Boy Scout tents, summer tents, winter tents, circus tents, large tents, small tents, couples tents, every color. And they're all covered with blue or gray or black tarps. And when we came to this location here, which I'll describe to you in a little bit, we were located on the tennis courts at Seattle University, and I walked up, and do you remember the circus the first time you saw it, or the carnival the first time you saw it? with the bright halogen lights beaming down on the courts. That was the it was the first time that I saw this. I was at the other end of the move, and that was the feeling. That was the sense that I had when I walked up on it.
And why does Seattle need something like a tent city?
Survival and a sense of community for the homeless. If you were to look at a staircase, the first step, one step up from sleeping up on the ground or sleeping in front of some department store building, that's what we are. But we're a microcosm of a democratic society, and we work together. We're not allowed to have many more than 100 residents at a time, but 100 strangers work together in a completely almost perfect democratic society. It's somewhat amazing.
How does that work, Russell?
Pardon me?
How does that work? 100 people, strangers, getting together and
we vote as a community every Wednesday night for our leadership for the following week. Five community members are act as our executive committee for the front desk, and they work six-hour shifts. And we have a couple alternatives. Every rule, in our code of conduct, everything that is we do is voted on in that community.
And Seattle has seen several tent cities over the years, as you've mentioned. What kind of response have you seen from the government over the years?
In the very beginning, it was almost as if it was a welcome concept. Then immediately, individuals throughout the community responded, and we've had some wonderful responses from separate areas of the overall community, different neighborhoods, and wonderful responses from the faith-based community. But Tent City 4, our sister and partner in partnership, they haven't fared as well as we have in the past. They have actually had a group who has followed them around pretty much very very negative outlook toward their existence. So it's a 50-50 thing, depending on what time you. What time we're talking about. Our appearance here at Seattle University has been nothing but a positive experience. Probably even one or two dissenters at that.
And the media's response over the years, have you seen it change?
Yes, I have. I'm not really the one who could tell you the most about it over the years, but I have looked back into the history, and I have talked to many folks at various mediums, paper, radio, television, and they've indicated there's been a drastic change, and that coincided with the community's response.
And the community's response?
And right now we're in the limelight. Tent cities, I've got to say this, if it weren't for the tent cities being in that limelight, the issue of homelessness probably would be on the back burner here in Seattle.
And in a tent city in Seattle, is this a step towards opening up all green spaces for people sleeping safely there?
That's our ultimate hope, and that's our overseer's viewpoint. Now, we have a nonprofit organization, Share Wheel, who oversees our operation. City, as well as on any given time, 13 to 15 different indoor shelters, and that is the ultimate goal: safe green spaces, or let's have the community build 10,000, 20,000 affordable homes. You know,
Russell, I want to introduce you to a panelist that we have here outside on the streets of Seattle, freezing with us. We have Mike D, who's here from OCAP. It's the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, which recently organized a demonstration in Nathan Phillips Square in Toronto. Mike, given the history of Tent City in Seattle, obviously the clear gains in organizing these tent cities that have been made in Seattle, can you talk about Nathan Phillips Square and the experience of homeless people in Toronto and their efforts to sleep safely outside.
Yeah, the main thing I think to understand right off the bat with Nathan Phillips Square is exactly what it is. It's not a unfortunately a large lush green space. It's Toronto City Hall, and it's a big concrete square. It's framed on the one side by a spaceship-looking building where the city council sits and has their offices. And that's where people sleep, is right in front of the doors of City Hall. And the reason that people do that is what's sort of important to understand about Nathan Phillips Square. Over the past few years in Toronto, there's been sort of a push to cleanse out the parks of downtown Toronto and make them look something like I suppose the city council imagines Disneyland to look like, trying to move people out of the parks to present this pristine image of Toronto. And the result has been that the people who sleep in the parks, or people who sleep under bridges or in doorways of buildings, on the streets, in buildings, people who make those choices end up getting in a very vulnerable position where the police can come along under orders from city council, under orders from provincial legislation, and basically move people along. And that's the mentality of the city. And as people have been moved along, and our own tent city that was started up in Toronto along a patch near the lakeshore was evicted. And eventually people become the victims of this move-it-along mentality, but there's nowhere else to move to. And the thing that's made Nathan Phillips Square unique is that it's the one space left, and unfortunately I probably should say it's the one space that was left in the city where people were free from the police force coming along and waking them up and moving them along. It was sort of a thing where people were tolerated to stay at Nathan Phillips Square. And what we've seen happen now is that our mayor has come in on a supposedly progressive agenda, and being elected on a progressive agenda to eliminate the homeless problem, he's chosen instead to make an attempt to make the homeless invisible instead, an attempt to ban them. So now for the first time under this supposedly progressive mayor, we've seen people now under a new city bylaw that was just passed actually banned from sleeping in Nathan Phillips Square. And that was done without any sort of indication of where exactly the mayor now expects people to move along.
We're gonna come back to this issue of this move along mentality, Russell. I'd like to get your comments on that, but I want to bring nobody into the conversation. I also want to bring the listeners who are now hearing us across the United States and across Canada as we've linked up with the U.S. Marathon again, running in its eighth edition. This year, with our third annual edition of this marathon, we're now connected together and trying to build a cross-border conversation about the possibilities of opening up green spaces as safe spaces across this section of North America. If you'd like to participate in that conversation, listeners across the United States and Canada can give us a call at 1-866-763-4136. That number's toll-free for this hour for listeners in the United States. If you'd like to participate in this Canadian homelessness marathon, give us a call, 1-866-763-4136. Russell and Nobody, you're both on the line there. Nobody, perhaps you can introduce yourself as the founder of the U.S. Marathon. Could you talk with our listeners about how presenting the marathon on the FM dial, on community radio stations across the United States, is an effort to reclaim public space in the struggle to end homelessness in the United States?
Well, I'm happy to do that. I'm happy to be on the Canadian Marathon, but let me just do a little housekeeping here. First of all, I can barely hear you. Second of all, people cannot call the American Marathon because our boards are not hooked up, so we cannot give you our call. Okay, so we'll have to just take the calls through Canada. But and also, let me just note, we're not just on community stations in the United States. We're on college stations. We're on NPR stations. We're even on one Christian station. But to get to your main point, I think that we are, and again, I don't know what's going on in Canada in this regard. But here in the United States, the news, we just did an hour on the media, homeless issues just don't get reported in the press here in a meaningful way. We really have a lot of stuff about drug addiction, mental illness, and we have virtually nothing about the cutbacks in public housing and the need for a living wage, The coverage is very biased in terms of blaming the poor, which is the kind of political slant that we have, because the people who are taking all the money want you to believe that the people who don't have the money are the ones responsible for their own plight. And the homelessness marathon started really as an outcry, really an outcry about what a disgrace it is. We got people on the streets of the richest country on earth. It's been very well received, and it's grown, but we are trying to present a radically different, not radical, just truthful, but radically different from what I view as the mendacity of the mainstream media kind of view.
Russell, in terms of the analysis that Jeremy is providing of the media coverage in the U.S., do you see that out in Seattle?
We do and we don't. Seattle's number four on the HUD list for what it does in terms of poverty and homelessness. Feed very well, clothe very well, medical is provided pretty very well for a United States city anyway. We just don't shelter the way we should. Seattle is very conscious, though, compared to a lot of the other cities throughout the states, yes. But he's absolutely right for the most part.
In terms of this issue of a move-along mentality, the tent city that you have there in Seattle, has it been met with that move-along mentality?
We haven't. Tent City 3 hasn't recently, but yes, in its earliest inception, certainly. And our sister Tent City 4 faces that on a day-to-day basis. Yes, that's an absolute. We have the naysayers, those who have their own stigmas.
How do you challenge that, Russell? What do you say to somebody who says you should just move along? Why camp here?
We just have regular voices before city councils and county councils and state councils, and we have friends in the media, and we don't give up.
Gretchen, if I can jump in here, I'd like to make one point about what's going on in Seattle, which is that in the 30s, they had something, I can't remember, I think it was it called Shantytown, or it might have been actually called Hooverville. There were things called Hooverville.
Yes.
And it was on city land, and people in the Depression were allowed to build a shantytown in Seattle on city land, and they were able to build semi-permanent structures so that they could put a little wood stove or something inside of a structure. And today, they're not really allowed to do that. If they keep moving around, you can't do that. And so really, conditions for homeless people in the Great Depression in Seattle were better than they are today. And this has everything to do with psychological attitudes, because in the Great Depression, they were saying, well, we know everybody is just in terrible shape. Today, we're in a kind of denial in America. There may be some more sophisticated explanation, but this comes back to the question of what are we trying to achieve. We're trying to really raise consciousness about these attitudes, because it's just crazy that in 2005, people should be living worse than they were in the depths of the Great Depression.
Mike, in terms of the situation in Toronto and the move-along mentality that you described, how does the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty act to combat that mentality, that move-along mentality that you talked about?
Well, it's obviously very difficult. The problem is that, you know, the politicians are very tactful in where and when they choose to strike. And, you know, the basic approach that we take is the fact that their move-along mentality has one fatal flaw. They've already pushed people out of the streets of the city. They're pushing people out of the parks during the summer. They push people out of Nathan Phillips Square now. And people have been pushed and pushed and pushed into the ravines that run along one side of the downtown of Toronto. People have been pushed underneath the overpasses and underneath the bridges that span the lakeshore in Toronto. And the fact is there's nowhere else to push people except into the lake. And people will survive and people will find resourceful ways of existing, because people exist. And that's one of the major problems that we face in Toronto, is this refusal to accept the fact that people exist, and that this isn't something that can be swept away. So in terms of challenging this mentality, it's just a matter of constantly pushing for positives It's a matter of pushing for housing, keeping constant pressure on all levels of government, not just for housing, but for all basic necessities. And it's a matter of standing with people when those forces do come in and try to enforce the move-along mentality. During the summer, when we first started to hear rumors that the police were going to begin to clear and the city council was going to pass laws to clear out Nathan Phillips Square, immediately, you know, people that were sleeping there began to organize and began to speak out against this. There was massive rallies during the summer, and it's very notable that the city council has come along now in the wintertime when they've managed to open up emergency shelters. There's the Toronto Out of the Cold program. And now when you're talking about clearing Nathan Phillips Square in the dead of winter in Toronto, you're talking about clearing out probably like 30, 40 people. During the summertime, you're talking about clearing out closer to 200 people. And back come this summer, all those people are still going to be around. Those people haven't gone anywhere. Those people aren't going off to cottages in the summer. Those people are still going to be there. But of course, the city council by then will have enforced this bylaw. And the fact is that people are always going to be somewhere, and wherever those people are, they're going to be standing and fighting, and we're going to be standing along with them. And that's and as we fight to, you know, push for better solutions, that's pretty much all we've been put in the position of being able to do.
Listeners, do call in with your comments, 1-866-763-4136. Again, that number's toll-free, 1-866-763-4136. We're talking about green spaces as safe spaces. If you have questions about sleeping outside, if you have questions regarding homeless people in public spaces, if you have a comment about homeless people in public spaces, do give us a call, 1-866-763-4136. What should we be doing in our towns and cities to make it safe for people to sleep outside when the shelters fill up, when people choose not to go to the shelters? What kind of guarantees can they have that they can sleep safely outside? Do give us a call, 1-866-763-4136. Russell, in Tent City 3, have you found it easier to survive being homeless in Seattle, given this environment that you live in now?
Oh, it's an absolute. I'm with my partner, my wife, Angela, and couples in particular in this city. It's almost impossible to find any type of shelter together. You can count on separation. In families, I understand it's even worse. So they may be split up as many as four or five places in a single night. So it's absolutely difficult. But the 10 cities that we have here even give you a chance at responsibility, and you can restore your own dignity. And I can't emphasize enough the sense of community that's given by this experience. So, yes, it's an absolute essential to have us here now. And also, because we're, as I said, indicated earlier, that we're almost like a circus atmosphere in appearance when you walk up. The media is constantly taking a look at us, as well as the community, and we seem to be the single voice that's left in Seattle for all of the homeless.
It's interesting that the media and the government provides you that space in some ways that you haven't been removed. It's a surprise to me that something like a tent city can survive as Tent City 3 has in Seattle, but the tent city that existed in Toronto was cleaned out by the city and cleaned out by Home Depot. And so it's a bit surprising to me that that Seattle would be such a welcoming space to this. And Russell, I'd like to get your comment on that, but I'd like to also get comments from our listeners regarding this difference in the response between the Toronto city government and corporations like Home Depot, and also the response of the city in Seattle to Tent City 3. Why is there such a remarkable difference between these two cities? Again, give us a call if you have thoughts on that question. 1-866-763-4136. It's almost 4:30 here in Montreal. This is the 12th hour of our homelessness marathon here in Canada. We've got two more hours to go, and this is the hour in which we link with the U.S. Marathon. Russell Mace of Tent City 3, your thoughts on the difference between the two reactions Is Seattle particularly a unique place in receiving and welcoming this tent city?
I think it's, to be clear on this, I think Seattle's just now coming around the corner. They're just realizing, they're waking up. Homelessness is an epidemic proportion. I mean, if we were to have an earthquake here in Seattle, the number of people that we already have out in the streets would be attended to immediately, you know. We live in a disaster every day. When I say Seattle's doing well, it's just because they just started doing it.
Robert from San Fernando Valley, you're on the line with us.
Hello.
Hi, Robert. Welcome to the Canadian edition of the Homelessness Marathon. What station are you listening to us on?
Thank you. I'm very nice. It's 1-866 number, so I don't have to pay for the line.
You're in the San Fernando Valley there?
Yes.
What station are you listening to us on?
90.7, I believe, on the meter. It says 90 FM 90.7.
Well, thanks to 90.7 out there for carrying the U.S. Homelessness Marathon. You had a comment on safe spaces?
Yes, it is very hard to get around here, especially with all police going on and everybody very, very not good. Like, when you have no paper to work, it is hard to get around and make money and go anywhere to do anything because, you know, no paper, what you do, and you just sit around, nobody help you, and they want to take you to jail, and, you know, I am scared. I don't know what to do.
And so what do you think should be done?
Well, they should have an area area for people to go and work, to do special services and live in a building where they can repay by working and doing labor for shelter and food.
Robert, thank you very much for your comment.
I don't know what to do, but if you know anyway, I'll be listening. I hope one person will be generous to raise money and experience, you know.
Thank you so much, Robert, for calling in.
All righty.
You too.
You guys, everybody, you say have a good night. I will try to be okay. Good night, too, and hopefully it will happen in the near future.
Sleep safely, Robert. Thank you very much. Calling in from the San Fernando Valley, participating in this link-up between the U.S. Marathon and the Canadian Marathon. This is our chance to talk about homelessness across borders, to look at it across our section of North America.
Yes, I definitely agree. I think they should make raise money for a marathon and have a marathon. I'll be there. I'll try to be as much as I can. I'll come and join, and hopefully we raise enough money to get this developed and make the whole city and around us much better environment.
Let's come back to the issue of tent cities in Seattle and tent cities in Toronto. Again, listeners, if you want to jump in on the call, the number is 1-866-763-4136. Again, that number is 1-866-763-4136. Mike, yourself in Toronto, you heard Russell's reaction to the idea of Seattle's reaction to a tent city. Why do you think Toronto was so quick to eliminate and somewhat, as you said, force the invisibility upon all of those residents of Tent City?
Well, I'm sure that there's not actually that much of a difference in the mentalities between the Toronto City Council and the Seattle City Council. I think it's all a matter of, you know, what can be put across and what they can get away with to some extent. And it's interesting, we were talking earlier, people were mentioning the sort of media perception. And media perception is part of it, but it has its limits. But I think what's interesting is that the only times in Toronto that I've heard people in poverty, people living on the streets, have actually a voice is when they've created things like the tent city, when they've taken over buildings in a very public way, when people have taken over buildings and created communities among themselves that are sort of thrust into the public spotlight. And you know, the one of the things that excites me most about tonight is that people are being actually encouraged to debate this issue and actually explore it in all of the different sort of facets of it. But the thing is that struck me in this recent eviction of people from Nathan Phillips Square is that there was absolutely no consideration of the voices of the people that it was affecting. They didn't enter into the equation at all. Not once did the media or city council say, what do they think? There's this sort of impression that's tried to be conveyed by city council that people, for some reason, are very happy with sleeping in Nathan Phillips Square, and that people are very happy to be just moved along, or that it's just something that happens to them, and that there's not a diverse group of people with a whole range of situations and emotions that this is directly affecting. And instead they put the people in charge of hostel services, or the people that are in charge of city programs, and those are put on a pedestal to be the spokesperson for those that are affected. So, you know, I think that things like tent cities, as was pointed out, is like by Russell, is like the type of thing that's needed to begin to change the mentality of the city councils and begin to shape public opinion, because that's when people get their voice and that's when people can put their voice across. So you know, I think it's all a matter of what they've accomplished in Seattle. This probably had a lot to do with the type of reaction they're now getting, and with the type of situation that they've managed to create.
Gretchen, I've got a question, which I hope it doesn't sound like a totally ignorant question, but I'll admit that I don't know the answer, so I guess that makes me ignorant. And I think a lot of Americans don't understand this, so I'll speak for them. You know, you've got a better healthcare system than we do up there, and there are a lot of people I've heard saying, I'm moving to Canada now that Bush got reelected. There's a perception you don't have the Patriot Act up there, that Canada is a freer society than the United States. A lot of people believe that. And yet, you have a real injustice to the poor. You know, Michael Moore in Bowling for Columbine, if anybody saw that film, he was talking about how wonderful Canada was to the poor. There seems to be some dichotomy here. You know, you do have things in Canada that we don't have, but at the same time, you know, anyone who's been to Toronto has seen homeless people in terrible conditions all over the place. What gives? Why do you have this problem in Canada when you have such good things as national health care?
Mike, I'll let you answer that in just a second. Mark is on the line from Milwaukee. Mark, if you could just hold the line for a bit. I want to give the number out again. If you want to join Mark, if you want to join Russell, if you want to join Nobody, if you want to join Mike in this discussion, give us a call, 1-866-763-4136. Again, that number is 1-866-763-4136. What about this great big misconception of Canada?
Well, I think the first thing to say that yes, it is a complete misconception. I'll definitely grant you that I wouldn't want to be sick down in the States. I'd much rather be sick up here. But at the same time, I think this image of Canada as a great paradise is very, very, very much misrepresented and misunderstood in the States. And it's simply a false idea, because Canada is existing in the same sort of context as the United States. And just as in the United States, there is a lot of different layers of society here, and those top layers of society are running on the bottom layers. And there's definitely big differences between Canada and the United States. But the fact is that, you know, the people that are living in poverty in Canada are living in the same sorts of situations as people living in poverty in the United States. We have hundreds, thousands of people across this country that are living on the streets. We have hundreds and thousands of people that are living in rundown housing projects. We have hundreds of thousands of people living underground here without status in this country. And you know, we definitely face, I think, the same sort of challenges as the States.
When you talk about the situation here in Canada, and you think about the contrast in the States, you bring out this idea of misconceptions. When someone's homeless in Canada, how much access do they have to the healthcare system?
Well, the one thing that you're going to come up against right away is the fact that, you know, a lot of people are facing access to services issues in terms of, like, losing their IDs, in terms of simply not being able to properly sort of navigate the different bureaucracies and systems that are put in place and basically are set up, it seems, sort of as consciously created obstacles to people accessing services. And the idea of national healthcare, I don't know the states too well, but certainly the healthcare system here is better in theory, but the practice of that system is also generally very poor services, very poor execution, and the poorer you are and the less access to those services you have, obviously the poorer quality you're going to end up receiving. So I want to
take some calls if I can. Sorry to interrupt, Mike. We've got a lot of callers on the line at 1-866-763-4136. Mark, are you on the line from Milwaukee?
Yes, hello.
Hi, Mark. Welcome to the U.S. the Canadian Homelessness Marathon, joining up with the U.S. Homelessness Marathon for this hour. It's 4 a.m. here in Montreal. What station are you listening to us on in Milwaukee?
Well, I'm getting a web stream from DC Indie Media. It's almost 4 o'clock here also, so I guess you're just straight north of me.
So tell us your question or your comment.
Well, I've been technically homeless since, I'd have to look it up on my DD-214 form. I think it's June of 91. I got out from Colorado Springs toward the end of Desert Storm. I run a homeless shelter, Casa Maria Catholic Worker House, for room and board the last 2 or 3 years. I've been a busker playing guitar for tips since before I joined the Army. I wasn't homeless till after I left the Army. Earlier you were asking, like, what could each town do to make things better for people who are homeless, people who are moving along, whatever.
What do you think about that?
Most primary thing each town could do, I think, is repeal whatever panhandler legislation that you have. You already have laws against me punching you in the face or hitting you over the head with a squeegee or whatever. If something goes wrong, I can go to jail for that. I don't have to go to jail for being a homeless person or for being a guitarist playing for tips. Became harder and harder and harder every year to even make 10 or 20 bucks before. They want 60 in Boulder. They want 90 in, I think, Denver. Connecticut's worse. You don't make that much money in Connecticut. I used to make about $5 an hour gross there. Milwaukee, Wisconsin, I don't know, 9 or 10 an hour. Green Bay, Wisconsin, $17 an hour in the summertime. Of course, poor in the wintertime, obviously.
Mark, hearing this discussion about tent cities in Toronto and Seattle, do you think Milwaukee could use a tent city?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And then who should organize that?
For Milwaukee area, if it was like Green Bay, maybe college students getting it rolling or something, trying their hardest to live out there and find out what it's like for the rest of us. But then much more hardcore people that can stay a lot longer. Me, who did 3 years in the Army, whatever, you know. That's a big issue is prior service. You know, and you were talking about healthcare earlier. The only fear I have running a homeless shelter for my room and board right now is if I get sick, something beyond stomach flu or whatever. There is no healthcare in the United States for me. Someone wants to hear my story and say, oh, you know, we'll write off that $80 bill or that $800 bill or let it get up to $3,000. Let me, by God, have appendix trouble, whatever. I think that's like $1,400 now in this country for traditional health care. No one's going to help you get that. So you'll have that bill the rest of your life or jail. They're starting to threaten in some cities. I think people fought that and won in a couple of the earliest ones that were doing that just this year.
Mark, thank you very much for your contribution.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Yes. Other listeners can join the discussion. 1-866-763-4136. That's 1-866-763-4136. Given the thoughts of the listener that just called, did anyone have any comments that they wanted to throw out there?
I think one of the interesting things he raises is the idea of the tickets and the fines that I know exist across Canada and certainly in the States as well. I would presume, and as the caller pointed out, the idea of these tickets in Toronto, at least, which is where most of my experience comes from, the idea of these tickets is that when the police come across someone sleeping in a green space, in a park or on the street, They can give you a ticket for any number of things that have to do with you living there, with carrying out the normal functions of living. And these things are fineable when they take place in a public park. And these tickets aren't about an expectation of even punishment, let alone collecting money. The expectation of these tickets is then control, because in Toronto and in Montreal and in Vancouver and across Canada, and most certainly across the states, the biggest public housing projects and the biggest public housing for poor people are the jails and the prisons that go across the country. And the sort of idea of these tickets is very clearly that you just run up a tab and you collect hundreds and thousands of dollars worth of tickets. You collect hundreds and thousands of dollars worth of fines. And then when the police come across you, then they've got control over you and they can put you in the only mass scale public housing project that the city has created, which is the Don Jail in Toronto. And there's similar facilities right across all of North America. So I think that this sort of idea of finding people is very key to why safe green spaces like the Tent City need to be created and protected, because that's where people are going to be safe from that type of harassment and that type of control exerted by the state.
The question for the hour again is green spaces as safe spaces. What do we need to be doing in our towns and cities across this section of North America, both in Canada and the United States? What do we need to be doing so that people can sleep safely outside if need be? We have Van Nuys, California on the line with us. Is this Lauren?
No, ma'am. Lucienne.
Lucienne. I'm sorry. I couldn't read the handwriting here on this wet piece of paper. We've got some chilly, chilly rain coming down here in Montreal.
Oh,
so the
ink
tends to run in those conditions. You've got some ideas about what should happen in L.A.?
Yes. Well, hearing these stories is very humbling. I myself have never been homeless. I'm not homeless. Very humbling. And I do see, I notice homelessness where I live around here. And, for instance, there's a burnt-out, kind of abandoned building not far from where I stay. And I wonder why city council or state council or what have you doesn't allot funds to maybe refurbishing these buildings and making living spaces and also adding maybe occupational centers where these people can be rehabilitated and you know, learn a craft and a skill, or you know, get on their feet. And also just maybe if you could kind of maybe throw out a few suggestions of things that, you know, somebody, an individual could do who does have a heart for these people, and something that they could do to help. Thank you
very much. Again, calling from Van Nuys, California, participating in this link up between the Canadian and U.S. homelessness marathons, the U.S. marathon in its 8th edition, the Canadian marathon in its 3rd. You can give us a call too, 1-866-763-4136. Again, that number's toll free, 1-866-763-4136. Let's take the questions and the suggestions that were just posed to the streets of Seattle and the streets of Toronto. Russell, your thoughts on those suggestions.
Oh, good. Thank you, Gretchen, because boy, I really wanted to talk to Lucian. And thank you, Lucian, for calling, because you don't know how much it means for others outside of our plight to listen in. To Mike, Mark, Nobody, Jeremy, whoever you are, Gretchen, Lucian, thanks for everything. But I'll tell you what, the city of Seattle had the old city hall, and we were looking at that to get maybe 1,000 individuals off the streets and into it. And we got the city council to go yes, but the mayor backed out at the last minute. But that is the idea. The counties that you live in, the cities that you live in, have massive numbers of buildings that are probably available, empty, and ready to go. And I think that'd be a good answer to not in the long term. It isn't the complete answer, but I think for now, it'd be a great answer to muster up all of those buildings, get the cities involved, get the counties involved, and find shelter through that venue.
Why hasn't
It's not an easy task.
Why hasn't it happened yet, Russell? Why are these buildings still empty in Seattle?
I cannot give you a solid answer. I've heard rationales such as they don't meet, they're not up to code, they don't meet ordinance standards, they don't meet disaster codes on the federal level. So I've heard several answers on that. The bottom line is,
I don't think it's politically correct to put the people in those buildings yet. As progressive as and ahead as Seattle is, they're still not ready for that. That would be an answer to temporary solution. The bottom line for us here, and I suspect everywhere in the country, is affordable long-term housing. We have a gentleman here at Tent City who's confined to a wheelchair. He's been on the housing list for 2.5 years now. One reporter said that the county average is 10 years to get affordable housing. I don't know if that's a correct statistic or not.
Mike, your thoughts on refurbishing buildings in downtown Toronto? Has the city made any moves towards refurbishing buildings so that people can find a place to sleep in Toronto?
Actually, on the contrary, the City Council of Toronto, despite the fact that, again, we had an election recently and we had a mayor who was elected on a supposedly progressive platform, and although he promised initially to actually open up city-owned buildings, the city is actually in the middle of a process, very concentrated process, to sell off any buildings that it owns. And those sales are taking place not to anybody who's going to build housing, not to any type of city build program, not to any provincial build program, but actually to condo developers. And that's how the city is turning a profit. And, you know, there's simply, you know, I think Russell said something that should just be said over and over again. We're talking about homelessness tonight, and there's a very simple solution to homelessness, and it's absolutely ridiculous that in our dialogue about it, and in the national, both of our national dialogues in Canada and the U.S., we don't say it a little more clearly, is that the answer to homelessness is housing and building housing and creating a society that's not so sick that it decides that some people get a home and some people don't get a home and some people get to eat and some people don't get to eat. And, you know, in Canada today, earlier on the marathon, actually right off the top of the marathon, the Canadian Minister of Homelessness came on the show, and he was lucky because today he announced that he was going to throw $2 billion at the problem of homelessness. And the fact is that, you know, $2 billion sounds like a lot of money, but who's going to see that money? And where's that money going to go? The city's already saying that, you know, bills that the federal government, the provincial government's promised haven't been delivered. The funds are delivered to research committees. The funds are delivered to bureaucracies that take years to solve the problem. If there was a serious will to solve the homelessness problem, it would be simply the creation of housing. And in the United States, Russell and nobody, you guys must be just sickened. The fact is, in the United States, that, you know, how many billions and billions and billions of dollars is the government throwing away on imperial adventures overseas, and they claim that they can't house people within their own borders. They have to cut food stamps in the most recent U.S. budget to pay for conquering other countries. And,
well, you know, you hit the nail on the head. Regardless of where you point to, you got money going out the window to Star Wars, mm-hmm. which
yeah.
No way will it ever work. No scientist, no reputable scientist believes it's ever going to work, I think. But the point here is, it isn't that there is a shortage of solutions. The solutions are easy.
Yeah.
What's lacking is the will to implement them. And that's really the raison d'etre for the marathon, is that this is only going to change when the people of these countries, both countries and around the world, insist on having their needs met by their governments. And when that happens in the United States, we have the ways and means to solve this problem. The reason it's not getting solved is our government simply doesn't have the will to do it.
Our hour is slowly or quickly winding down here. This is the hour that we've connected with the U.S. Homelessness Marathon, broadcasting from New Haven, Connecticut this year. Is that correct, nobody?
Absolutely.
We have Raj on the line from Toronto. Raj, are you there?
Yes, I am. How are you today? Happy Valentine's Day, everybody.
Thank you very much, Raj. It's late into the Valentine's morning after, I suppose. It's almost 5 a.m. here on the streets of Montreal. Can you talk about what should change regarding the use of public space in Toronto, where you're calling from? What kind of change do you think we need
to see? I've got a couple of concerns of my own that I would like to add to your discussion.
Go ahead.
I'm a taxi cab driver at night time, and I see a lot of homeless people in downtown Toronto, up and down Yonge Street, Richmond, and all that area. And my concern is that when these people sleep on the street, when it gets icy outside, they kind of tend to slide towards the road. And I've seen a lot of these people get hit. Why can't we just tell them to sleep closer to the wall? Because they have had a couple of coincidences that were not good.
Raj, so that's your suggestion? People need to take...
No, my suggestion is that these people need help. We don't need to go to other countries and help people. We need to stay in our own country and help ourselves. That is one number one problem. But besides all of this, even though we set up all these facilities for these people to go to, sometimes they just don't go there. Sometimes they just like to live on the street. When someone doesn't want to help themselves, you can't help them, my child.
Okay.
That's true. I've been at the point of my life where I could have easily sat on the corner of the road and watched the guard donkeys go by in my own country. But I don't want to do that. I come to this country, I'm not from here, and I work every day and every night, and I support my 5 children. I choose to live my life like that. When a person sits on the corner of the street, and the only thing they do is reach out for money, that is not helping. You're giving money for someone to sit there. That is not right.
If I could just jump in and put Raj's comments in a little bit of context, especially for people listening in the northern U.S. may be able to relate to this, but some of our southern U.S. visitors might not understand one thing, is that one reason that people sleep close to the curb is that in Canada, it's freezing here in the winter, and close to the curb, at least in Toronto, I'm not sure about here in Montreal, is tends to be where they put the hot air grates, and that's where people tend to sleep in the winter so that they can stay warm without freezing to death. And yes, people are sleeping on those hot air grates even in the winter time, because as Raj said, yes, some people do not want to go into the facilities that are provided by the city. In the city of Toronto, there are massive homeless shelters that have been built that house hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people in one facility, and there's dozens and dozens of facilities concentrated around the downtown east side. And those facilities are overcrowded, they're infected with tuberculosis, with bed bugs, and they're generally very dehumanizing, degrading places to be, and people do choose to live an independent existence, and unfortunately in the wintertime in Canada, that means occasionally sleeping on hot air grates close to the curb, which is obviously dangerous.
We only have a few minutes left in this hour. I want to get a round table of comments from the guests that we have on the line with us. Raj, thank you for your call from Toronto. I neglected to ask you what station you were listening on. I suppose we have time for one last call. Willie has joined us on the line from San Francisco. Willie, welcome to the Canadian Homelessness Marathon, joining up this year with the U.S. Marathon at 4 a.m.
Hi, and thank you, and happy after Valentine's Day to everybody that's listening.
Thanks, Willie. You had a brief comment?
Yes, I do. I am a homeless person, and I have a job, okay? And I was listening to the taxi cab driver, what he was saying, and you also have somebody that you call Nobody, who had a guest on his show, which was the editor of our street sheet here in San Francisco at the Coalition on Homelessness. Let me just say this real quick. When it comes down to it, if a person only has X amount of dollars and rental rates are sky high, whether people believe this or not, it is better to be homeless and have money on you than to be living somewhere and not have any money to function with. All right? And as far as your 10 cities go, there's a safety factor there. I mean, 10 cities are okay. Please understand, I'm for it. But because I was a victim of a crime against a homeless black man, just because I was homeless and a homeless advocate, it kind of tells people that besides tapping government sources, they should also...
You are listening to the 8th Annual Homelessness Marathon, produced in conjunction with WPKN Community Radio in Bridgeport, Connecticut. The opinions expressed on this broadcast are not necessarily those of the producing or participating organizations or of the originating or affiliated radio stations. To view the webcast of this broadcast, order tapes, or contact Nobody after the show, go to www.homelessnessmarathon.org. It's all-